Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. Hey guys, we decided to drop in during our break to release what was originally a patron-exclusive bonus episode. Over on our Patreon, we treated the Green River Killer series a bit like a book club, so with this episode, we answer some outstanding questions listeners had, along with our personal thoughts and opinions on the books we read to cover this series. We will be back in just a few short weeks to bring you some regular content, and stay tuned for the end of the episode where we tease our next book. This episode contains foul language, discussions about murder, rape, and necrophilia. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped.
Welcome back again, patrons.
Oh, wait, is this just for patrons?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, great. Hi, patrons.
We brought together, well, I did, as Olivia was surprised.
Yeah, I
put together a little Gary Ridgway wrap-up. I know we just spent 2 entire months listening to nothing but bullshit about him.
Oh, God.
But I did put out a little call on our Patreon to see if anyone had questions. I also put that on our Instagram to see, like, if anyone had, like, overall thoughts. If anyone was like me and thought that you knew what this case was and truly had no idea. Someone just asked me the other day, like, completely not related to the show. One of my friends from the Ariel studio was like, should I read this book? And I was like, if you think you know everything about this case, you should read this book.
Yes. Yes.
Always read Anne Rule. She has all the details.
Always.
So the number one question that I got from a couple people in Patreon and not was what happened to Judith. We kind of cut her story off with Gary being arrested and asking her to divorce him. She did move on. She moved out of the house that they shared because she had to sell it for the money. And like we said in the show, her asshole brother-in-law was like, why aren't you giving Gary the money? So from there, her life kind of got worse and worse for a long time. So I have a little bit of a write-up about Judith and then a couple other sections we're going to talk about. So for Judith's future, after Gary was arrested, her life was tumbling in slow motion from the divorce to hearing that he confessed. And she was numbing her reality with wine and pills for good reason. For months after his arrest, she would frequently hear people shouting up to her house from the street, screaming murderer and yelling obscenities about the Green River wife. Ugh. So she sat in the dark for a long time with the curtains drawn, hoping to deter vandals that would throw rocks at her house and smash her planters.
So did she stay in the state of Washington?
Yes.
Okay.
She stayed in the same area. But she knew she had to get out of the house, even like before she had to sell it for money. She knew she needed to get away from the house because people were harassing her and like she couldn't leave. She had to, Gary helped her from prison. He like helped her kind of buy a car because they kept all their vehicles for evidence.
Yeah.
So I think she actually got the car. And then I want to say, I could be mixing this up with another detail because she did wreck a car while they were married. But I'm pretty sure that she ended up having to buy a new car and then wrecked it. Like, because she was driving so distracted and was so fucked up all the time. Not fucked up, like, on substances, but she just, like, should
just
not have
like
been.
Mentally not okay.
She shouldn't have been behind the wheel of a car. So, the ultimate act of cruelty that she endured during the process of Gary working with the police and doing all of this body recovery with the task force was that at one point she asked a neighbor to watch her cat and he didn't understand what had happened with Gary and why police were all over their house. He found out while she was gone and he still had the cat and then he wouldn't give her cat back.
What the fuck?
He screamed in her face and was like, no, you're married to a fucking serial murderer. You don't get this cat back. Which like, if I was Judith, there's no information either. Penny Moorhead or Judith, like, they don't confirm that she ever got the cat back. I would have slashed her tires, called the police, and said, do you want to see me make a fucking scene?
Right.
Because let's talk about who the Green River Killer is.
Yeah.
I will yell for all of the neighbors to see that his wife is on your lawn and is not leaving. So.
Oh, my God.
Judith eventually moved into her parents' trailer in 2002 after the house sold. She was more isolated there, but reporters still found her number, pleading with her in quiet voices when they called, telling her they were sorry for disturbing her. They knew she must be very upset and traumatized by what was happening, but they could really help her recover by telling her side of the story. She was always horrified to hear from these people, thinking that the rest of the world would never believe she was innocent. She told her friend Linda Bailey that she felt like she couldn't leave the house at all because people were going to stare at her. Like, surely people had seen her on the news and there was no way she could ever be in public that people would think she was in on it. Which is totally fine. Like, of course you would think that. Even though I don't think a lot of people knew who she was. Like, the case itself was so sensational. There was, in the grand scheme of the attention given to the case, I would say, like, not a ton of it was on her.
Yeah.
Especially because she wasn't talking. I think he had plenty of coworkers and friends who were more than willing to be on the news and talk about how they knew the Green River Killer. So after he confessed in 2003, she stopped visiting Gary in prison and had someone else tell him that she was seeing another man and couldn't talk to him anymore. He actually wrote her a letter and said that it was Dave Reichert. That Dave Reichert told him, Judith is with another man now. You might as well stop wasting your energy. But I don't think asked him. I think Dave Reichert told him that to fuck with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So she watched his sentencing hearing and when that was on TV and thought that that would close the book. She thought that Gary would transition into prison life without thinking about her. But letters started coming to her house, none of which she opened until 2004. She started with the most recent one dated January 4th, 2004. In the letter, Gary apologizes to her and tells her that he prayed to God in 1985 that if he could get away with this one last murder, he would stop and never kill again. To which I could not help but interject, okay, bitch. I was like an alcoholic, dry for a time, but then I fell off the wagon. And then he tells her that Sue Peters and Reichert refused to call her when he had the opportunity for visitors, and now he's on suicide watch. He says that people in prison call him madman, the devil, Satan, and a monster, but he spends his time praying for her every day, and he prays for the women he killed. He ends the letter by saying, God forgive sinners. Will he ever forgive me? Which, just all of it is...
All of that is disgusting.
It is. It's terrible.
You pray for them now after the fact.
Well, right. It's like, who are you? Why... No one cares.
But they don't need your prayers, Gary Ridgway.
No, they truly don't. No one does. And it's just, whatever God I serve doesn't see you. As non-religious as I am, whatever I believe in, you're not a part of it, period.
Nope. Nope. Nope.
In another letter, he asks her to put aftershave on a pillow at night when she misses him, which is the most grade school bullshit I've ever heard. She does answer that letter, but realizes even in the letter she's holding back from expressing herself, that she wants to say, like, I'm a broken person, how fucking dare you? But she just ends up saying, like, this is what's going on with the house. I talked to your brother. This is, you know, the dogs are fine. Like, she's being old faithful Judith. And she was just like, there's no reason for me to write him a letter if at all. There's no reason for me to talk to him if I'm not going to scream at him. And she's like, you know what? I would just rather not.
Fair.
So he knows this when he reads that letter and he responds with, I married you for life, like in his next reply to her. He says, I married you for life and I broke your heart. We had a real good life. I will love you always, Gary Leon Ridgway. So she does, over the course of time, write 3 to 4 responses and then decides she needs distance. Into late April, he's still writing her of 2004 and asking if she can forgive him. He starts sending her letters that are almost entirely scripture about the power of forgiveness. Into May and June, he keeps trying to give her self-help advice about going to church and finding new ways to earn money and take care of herself. He suggests that she should do other people's taxes. He wishes her happy Mother's Day and requests that she always put God first in her life.
Then there's I hate this so much.
He's a fucking douchebag tool. It's just like, how dare you tell me? But I guess...
How dare you give me any advice on anything at all?
I know. But to...
Other than murder.
Right. Which, to that effect, like, you're a fucking nightmare person. Don't talk to me ever. But at the same time, she does... I mean, coming from her perspective, she needs it. He helps her sell the house from in fucking prison. He, like, helps her, like, tells her how to buy a new car, like, who to go to. He gets her money from his IRA. Like, he has to sign those papers. And so, like, even while he's this terrible person who is a monster but is now helpless in prison, she still is, like, relying on him to help her get stuff done. Which I think is valid, because how do you function after you find something out like that? It's probably just easiest to, like, fine, let's do it this way, like you say.
Yeah.
So... there's a letter on August 28th, 2004 that's titled Emergency Numbers, and it is all Bible verses. This is the one that I took a screenshot of. It is item 100 in Penny Moorhead's book. It says, when in sorrow, call on John 14. It's cut off a little bit. When people fail you, call Psalm 27. When you worry, call Matt 16:19-30. When you want peace and rest, call on Matthew 11:25. For the secret to happiness, call, what is the C one? Colossians?
Literally.
Heathens. For the secret to happiness, call Colossians 3:12-17. When your faith, underlined four times, needs stirring, call Hebrews 11. When you're in danger, call Psalm 91. And I mean, that's like half of it. Not even
that. It's literally gross. Like nauseous.
Yeah. Just the idea that you get to sit in prison and read a Bible and think that that's good for you.
Right. And think that you deserve to be forgiven.
I mean, I think the only religion.
Your eternal soul is okay because you've accepted Jesus Christ.
I know. I mean, I think the only religion that I would ascribe to, Satanism, is the only one that's like, yeah, once you pass a certain point, like, there's no one here for you.
Like, literally no one.
I think every other major religion does preach acceptance and forgiveness when you're ready to accept what you did and accept that savior into your heart. But I'm just like, I don't think so.
No.
Especially coming from this guy who, like, clearly knows what he's doing is wrong. He is not mentally incapacitated in any way.
Yeah.
He just feels like he's an addict.
Ugh.
So after, yeah, cannot. After the emergency numbers letter, the last letter is the pinnacle apology letter. He tells her he's sorry for hurting his son and for killing all those young women. He talks about Bible verses that preach about speaking from the heart and apologizes to everyone down the chain, to the taxpayers that have had their money cover such a horrible thing, to the investigators that he put through gruesome scenes, to his entire family and Judith's entire family. And, I mean, that's just the end of it. He's just like, I'm sorry for everything I've done. I wish I could have been different. So she ties the letters up to store them away, and she knew without a doubt that she was done with Gary Ridgway. He was never getting out, and there could be no coming back from this. Judith thought about all the things she needed to do and said she just had a moment of clarity where she felt very alive. That all of a sudden she, like, had a cold chill and stood up from her chair and was like, I have to call people. I have to go, like, check in on all this shit I've been ignoring. I have to, like, clean the rugs in my house. She was just like, all these mundane things that you don't find any joy in. She was like, I get to do that stuff by myself now.
Good for you, Judith.
I know. In 2005, her friend Linda Bailey introduced her to Penny Moorhead, and they became friends. So she actually, I don't think she was an author before this.
Oh, okay.
She is, among a lot of other things, a handwriting analyst, and she knew other authors that could help them. So they decided to write the book together, and it was released in 2007. Judith credits her health in the process of healing to writing the book, that she really, for like a year and a half, was solely existing off of red wine and taking pills.
Yeah.
So in a People magazine article that I already posted on Patreon, Judith talks about the letters from Gary to the author, Nicole Egan. And she says that what you have to understand is that every memory she has is of a man she loved, not a man that was a stranger to her. So then I really felt like through this whole thing that I don't have, like we talked about in one of the episodes, I didn't have a good understanding of who Gary Ridgway was. He's just so weird because you don't ever see him get angry. You never see the side of him that murdered those women. And I just didn't understand, like, it's even in the interviews, I posted a link to a video with Mary Ellen O'Toole on the Patreon page where she's interviewing him. And she, like, I think it's her that says the famous line, like, she talks about Mary Ridgway to him and says, "You just wanted the bitch to shut up, didn't you?" And so she's trying to get on his side and say, like, "It's okay that you hated your mother. Tell me about it."
Yeah.
And then he says, "I guess if I could have, I would have slit her throat." And then in the same breath talks about watching her in her swimsuit and, like, having to hide his erection when they were outside together.
And it's, his mother?
Yes.
Oh.
And it's like, oh, that's where it comes from. Because everyone talks about how he's attracted to his mother, but not a lot of places get into those specifics because there's such little information available.
Yeah.
That goes into that level of detail. But anytime you can hear Mary Ellen O'Toole talk about that, it's worth listening to because you start to hear, even though while he's saying it, he has the most deadpan face. There's no emotion. It's like he's talking to you about where you're going to go get dinner. But you do start to hear him say all of these things that are like, oh, this is why you are the way that you are. So if you want to hear more from Mary Ellen O'Toole, there is an episode of FBI Retired Case File Review, True Crime, True Fiction, the podcast with Jerry Williams. I found it on Spotify. The cover art is blue and it has like a guy's hands and handcuffs holding money and a gun. And episode 75 from July of 2017 is an interview with Mary Ellen O'Toole talking about serial killers and sexual sadists, specifically Gary Ridgway. And she talks about like what it took to speak to him. And overall, she's like a really well-known. She worked with Ted Kaczynski and she has either interviewed or given her professional opinion on tons of serial murderers. She has a great blog. So in collecting all of these items where I was trying to find instances of like, how does he make me feel? How do I understand him better? There is a quote from a 2003 article in the Washington Post by Blaine Harden. It was released November 16th, 2003. The title of this article is called "The Banality of Gary, a Green River Chiller," which makes me want to die and slap the author.
I'm cringing right now.
He says the line, "He was nothing if not pragmatic. He liked killing prostitutes," he said, "because they were easy to pick up. They were slow to be reported missing, and if they had any money on them, they ended up paying for their own murder." So that was just like directly. There's nothing more complicated about his victim selection process than he. I think a lot of people think like, it just happens that way, that sex workers go missing and get murdered because, you know, that no one actually makes a connection. No one's going to look for them, so I better start there. He did. That was his entire thought process. No one is going to look for sex workers. Fuck them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where other people might just find themselves in that situation and then realize this is the option.
Well, and like just with his MO of like he didn't kill them all because that's what he wanted. He wanted to have sex all the fucking time. So where do you do that? You pay someone for it.
Yes.
So for him, it was like, I mean, yeah, like no brainer of why he would pick them. Like not only because they're not being found, you're not being missed, I guess. He thought what they did was bad, but he liked to pay for sex. So
yeah. Yeah. And I think that that truly gets into like later in the book where he's losing control. That's just that whole thing that I talked about, that he could not stand himself. Mm-hmm. He was so angry that he was part of what he hated.
Yep.
So a couple items that I found in, most of this comes from reading the prosecutor's summary of evidence in its entirety. I think it's about like 130 or 140 page document that from the court system and investigators, there is some graphic shit listed in it when you dive into it. I found out in reading that from front to back that not only we talked about he would give people jewelry from his victims when he would take it, he talks about how he always got rid of their clothes and he didn't keep anything. Like he didn't want to personally own any of the jewelry, and I don't think he gave any of it to Judith because he didn't want it in his house. but he would leave it in the bathroom at Kenworth for women to find. Like, he would sneak into the women's bathroom and put rings on, like, the sanitary product holders or leave a necklace on the counter. And then he would, like, get hard thinking about them finding it, or when someone would come out of the bathroom and he would overhear them saying, hey, did anyone leave this in the bathroom? I guess I'm going to take it up to the office and someone will come get it. Or realizing that they didn't know whose it was and just listening to them talk about this mystery ring or whatever it was, that he loved it.
Ew, I hate that.
Yes. There was also a very terrifying description of how he would take the victims out of his house. He would just drive his truck straight up to his front door in the middle of the night. Which, like, we have screenshots from Google Earth of all of his houses that I feel really weird about sharing because they are dated. Like, they're not, it's not who lives there now.
Right. But,
like, people's vehicles are out front and you can clearly see the fucking house numbers. I mean, you can find the house numbers anywhere. It's not a big deal to share them because anyone can look that information up. It just makes me feel gross. Maybe I'll just post them directly to you guys on Patreon.
There we go.
But he would drive the truck up to the door, and it had a camper shell on it, so no one could see what he was loading into it. But he would just take rugs or sheets of plastic and roll the body from the bed onto the floor, roll them up, and then drag them straight from the front door into the back of his truck.
Ugh.
And it's just like, how did no one ever see that happening?
Literally no one. Someone had to have.
The sickest instance... He took one woman out of his house in his son's footlocker, like an army trunk that you store belongings in at the foot of your bed.
Mm-hmm.
He shoved her in that and took her out.
And then he sold that at one of his garage sale things.
Yeah.
His swap meets.
So
someone has that trunk.
Yeah.
In their possession.
Imagine being that person. They hopefully to God, they don't know.
Right.
But you also can't imagine, like, every person that I bought something from at a garage sale in my hometown, I know who they are.
Well, right. If you were, like, buying something from him because him and Judith were so involved in that, I think you would remember that. And then as soon as all this went down, I would hope you would have either turned your possession over to the police or gotten rid of it if it wasn't needed. Because, like, you never fucking know.
I know. Hopefully they turned it in if they knew.
Yeah.
That is. I can't imagine what my reaction would be. I wouldn't want to touch it ever again.
No. No.
Ugh. And it was his son's.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that meant it looked specifically childlike, but just imagine buying that for your kid. Filth. Yeah. So, in general, how he got the bodies out of the house, we move into general treatment of bodies. The word psychopathy is said multiple times in the summary of evidence, so that's not me inserting this word. They are talking about him directly as if he is a psychopath. And they talk about, I knew that there's this general story that he took his son out with him and left him in the car while he had a date. I don't know if I ever knew, like, I think I've heard other podcasts say that A, he either slept with that woman and then left and didn't murder her, or B, that he did kill her in the woods, like he had sex with her and then killed her there, and then got back in the car with his son and drove away. In the prosecutor's summary of evidence, that instance is him taking his son to one of the sites so he can rape a deceased body.
What is he telling his son? Like, oh, I'll be back. I have something to do in the woods.
He was 7 years old. He probably just said, I have to go to the bathroom. And that's theoretically in any instance. In this particular one, he said his son was asleep.
Mm-mm.
So he just left him in the car. And he said to the investigators that were questioning him, don't worry, he's a hard sleeper. He has no idea what happened. Yeah, was not concerned at all that this might have a lasting effect on his son's mentality.
Well, and I think it was just another thing for him to do that was kind of like naughty, you know, because that's why he liked to have sex with his consensual partners outside or somewhere that they could get caught, you know, like it was just one of those things again, like,
yeah, he that definitely he had
the potential to be caught.
He did say that he liked to go back. I mean, a lot of times it is stated that he just liked to do it out of convenience, that he wanted to have sex and that was free, but he liked owning those women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That it was an extra night that he could say, like, look at my prize.
Yeah.
In another terrifying moment that I didn't, in all of this reading, that I either missed or didn't realize. He and none of this, there's no relation of which victim is which of these stories. They don't relate, like, which person it is. It just says that he killed one sex worker in his truck that they had had sex in the woods, in his vehicle. He killed her there. And it was so early in the morning and he was cutting it so close that he just drove straight to work with her in the truck. And then on his lunch break, he drove back to the same spot with the body, raped the corpse, and then drove back to work without bothering to leave the body in the woods because it made him feel so powerful.
No. Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. I think these are the two, and I mean, I can stomach a lot.
Yeah, that's too much.
I'll eat food all day looking at crime scene photos and it doesn't bother me. I read that and I was just like, I'm going to bleach my eyeballs now.
Yeah, yeah, that's heinous.
The last item on this list is that he once tried to resuscitate a victim after he unintentionally killed her too quickly. And when asked why he would bother trying to resuscitate her if his ultimate goal was murder, he said he thought that he might torture her if he could figure out a way to do it in such a confined space.
No.
Like what you did wasn't enough? He was moving into prolonged torture?
No.
Yeah, so overall, his pride in what he did and the anger that motivated him comes through in the interrogation. He talks about missing an opportunity at one point. Like, he, for some reason, either someone sees them or he, like, fucks up this date with a woman. And he said he knew he needed to cool off before picking up someone else because if he didn't give him that time to calm down, he would have killed her on the spot. He said, I would have lost my mind and killed her in the street. And he was just like, I knew that I had to stop. So he made himself drive around before he circles the block again to pick someone else up. And she commented that his hands were shaking before he murdered her. And he says, yeah, well, I got picked up for prostitution. Like, for whatever the charge would be for him, for solicitation. And yeah. I am nervous. Like, I haven't done this since I got arrested. But I want to do it again. And then he killed her.
No.
So from that same article in the Washington Post, Blaine Harden says, with no measure of pride, or with no small measure of pride, Gary Leon Ridgway says strangling young women was his career. Choking is what I did, he boasted to investigators, and I was pretty good at it.
Horrified.
I am baffled how you just don't. I know it's not nice to say, but, like, just kill yourself.
Yeah.
I think this is a prime example that, like, no one needed you.
Right. No one needed you. And you, like, sit there and talk all the time about how much you hated yourself. Then why the fuck didn't you just end it? Everyone would have been better off, Gary Ridgway.
Yeah, like, very unfortunately, nobody, like, you know, even in, they just, it's so shitty that, like, even the worst person on earth means something to someone. And now, knowing as much as I know about Judith, like, it was her. That was why he didn't ever hurt himself.
Well, and he's a narcissist.
Oh, like, yeah. He didn't hate himself enough to do that.
No.
So he makes it clear, again, from the prosecutor's summary of evidence, that he would not claim to have killed a woman unless he did so. So, again, this is just more evidence. I think they're talking about Becky Marrero, that he was like, they're talking about her, but also someone else at this point. It was someone that they ended up charging him with, but he says, I'm not going to say that I did it because I didn't. And he makes it clear that he would not have claimed to have killed a woman unless he actually did so. He explained his reason, why, if it isn't mine, because I have pride in what I do and I wouldn't want to take that away from someone else. Sickening. Sickening.
Yeah.
So I did put out a little call on Patreon and Instagram to have anyone, if you have, like, wrap up feelings or if you had any questions or just, like, specific instances that you wanted more information on. And Brittany got back to us and said, I'm dying to know if the officers involved were invested because of their pride or because they value the lives taken. After listening to Detective Trap, and let's be honest, every awesome true crime podcast, I wondered if anyone cares about those who are in the sex work or street business. So many predators target those in a vulnerable and risky field. So I guess I'm in essence asking if there was something that stuck out to you about the detectives or task force involved that made us think that they cared more than their numbers. So, like, the sheer number of women that went missing and, like, the number of cases solved. And if anyone doesn't know or hasn't listened to Detective Trap, should definitely listen to that. It is the story of a murderer being caught through the eyes of a badass female detective. And she's pretty candid about, like, how she handles victims' families and, like, she gives a fuck. She, like, eat, breathes, and sleeps her job. I would say, since I read Chasing the Devil, that Reichert definitely, I think he cares, because at that point, it's impossible not to.
You can't, especially when you're being yelled at by family members who do actually love these women who are missing.
Yeah. I think, and I mean, like, yes, there is a ton that I disagree with him on. He is, to be quite frank, he is a Republican and an older man, like much older than me. He's from a different time and generation. So there's a lot that I disagree with him on. But I mean, I'm also biased. My father is a police officer, and I can say that, like, he's worked cases that have completely broken him as a person. So I think that he did. I think it's both. He clearly cares. Like, you can't be a sane person with an ounce of love that has your own daughter and not take those cases seriously and want to see them solved. But I'm sure that there's a huge part of you that just wants it to be over. You're so tired of being told you're incompetent. And you can't stand going to work every day and having to hear that, like, you're not doing a good job.
And I think with that, the sheer amount of victims did make people care.
Yeah.
Like, who's to say if Gary Ridgway had only killed 5 women in a 10-year time span, would anyone have cared? Would anyone have noticed if they were all sex workers? Probably not.
Yeah.
Because he just strangled them. He didn't do something, you know, really weird, torturous, like things like that to them. Like, they all probably would not have been lumped in the same category to be cared about. But because of his sheer volume in numbers, I think it made people care very quickly.
Yeah, I think the main thing, like, as far as if there was something that stuck out about them caring, I mean, that he had to deal with the families over and over again telling him that he was a fuck up. That, like, obviously, no matter what the reason is, like, you don't want to be told that. But then the moment where he tells his wife, like, I don't want you to tell me that you love me anymore. Because even that, like, something so simple that should make you feel better makes you feel worse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
It's
just, like, again, I'm sure, just by reading his book, he's very cocky.
Yeah.
He comes off as, like, I mean, he does. He eats crow a lot. He says, like, of course there's stuff we could have done. But he also, like, refuses in other places when people say you should have done this differently. He's like, maybe if I'd gotten up at 7:15 instead of 7:25, everything would have changed. But, like, what do you want me to do?
Yeah.
Which in some cases is justified. And in other cases, I tended to agree with the other person that was accusing him of not doing his job.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a combination. Like, anyone who is working on the Green River case, there's no one who could say that they weren't also in it to catch the serial killer and, like, be a part of that. But I think, too, in Anne Rule's book, when she's just, like, talking about the investigators and getting quotes from them, it's a celebratory thing when Gary Ridgway is caught, but it's also just, like, it's a big bummer because it took that long and the victim list is so high. So it's like they're definitely taking a toll in caring and being a part of it. Like, I think if no one really did care, I think it would have been more of a, like, we did this. But every single book that is written about it is like, this whole thing fucking sucked. Like,
every book about, like, from any perspective, it's like, you've never seen sadness like that.
Yeah. And I think that shows that they did care. Because if they didn't, it would just be a book of triumph, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, I have very specific, like, the whole reason that we did this series is because, like we said in the very first episode, I didn't know a single Green River victim's name. And, like, even in Reichert's book, they're not all mentioned by name. Not all of their stories are told to the extent that they're told in Anne Rule's. And, like, can I fault him for that? The book is about him.
Right.
It's not about, it's not even about Gary Ridgway. Like, it is. It's called, like, Chasing the Devil, My Time on.
Right. But it's about him.
Right. It's his,
like,
memoir. Yeah. So it talks about his life. It talks about his life before and after working on that case. So, like, I can't fault him for it. But at the same time, like, that's never good enough.
Yeah.
Definitely. There's no reason to, like, if for me, there's no reason to not, like, say every girl's name, to not say every bit of information you can about her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think if this was anywhere else, it might not have gotten the care that it should have. But because it was in the fucking state of Washington, where Ted Bundy just was, because it was coming off of that high, it mattered.
Yeah.
But I mean, as we've talked, things like that happened here in St. Louis, and no one cared.
Yeah.
And nothing was done.
If you butt up the timelines of how many serial killers here, Maury Travis, the package killer, like if you butt all those timelines up, at some point they overlap, and it's just like, those cases aren't as prolific, but in one instance, it's only because we've identified three victims and no murderer.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There's no one to talk about.
Yeah.
There is an instance in the book. When he goes to, I think it's when they do Sally Jesse Raphael. It's either that or after the Manhunt Live. It's after one of his TV appearances. And they feel really good about it, and they think it's going to like lighten the mood. It's really awkward and uncomfortable. But a lot of his coworkers like put out a fake red carpet and like a bunch of balloons. And they were like, hey, Hollywood. Like they were giving him shit. It wasn't to actually celebrate that he did anything.
Right.
It was to be like, all right, you're the top dog now coming back from doing the fucking daytime circuit. And it was just to like relieve some tension and be like, I'm glad that you did all of that. Now, like, let's come back here down to reality and get your ass back to work.
Yeah.
But their commanding officer at the time was like, I think it was it Adamson? Why do I have that name in my head? Frank Adamson?
I
think it was Frank
definitely,
Adamson.
Definitely. Yeah.
He was like, are you fucking kidding me? He took all the heat for it.
Oh.
He was like, I know that you didn't do this, but if you have been letting these officers run around and act like this, or if they didn't think that this would be appropriate from day one, then you're fucking up with your team.
Yeah.
You don't have them in check if you thought that that was in any way funny. And it's just one of those instances where, like, you can kind of see why they would do something like that. But then it's like, how are you this close and so out of touch?
Yeah.
But I think you also get so close to the gruesomeness that, like, it doesn't affect you in the same
way. Right. It doesn't affect you because you can't let it you wouldn't be able to do your job if you did.
The other day, some true crime author that we follow on Twitter that I've always been like, I should read her book, or this person, like, you know, I should read what they've written. She said something about the West Memphis Three and how she thinks it's disgusting that Damien Echols is famous or like an anti-hero, and how it was just like pure talking shit on him.
Yeah.
And I was the first person to ask a question, and all I said was, why do you think that he's disgusting? He didn't choose any of this. He never asked to be thrust in the spotlight. And then before she could even answer me directly, like 85 other people were like, fuck you, bitch. And I was just like, I'm not going to revisit that conversation. I don't want to be involved.
Yeah. But
her point later, as I was, you know, being me, drinking my drink with my fucking sunglasses on, scrolling through the comments like I was getting paid for it. She said, no one should be able to look at pictures of a dead baby and not have a reaction, that he just like laughed and said he was glad that it happened and he didn't care if the person ever got caught, which he said that. He said, I don't really care. I didn't do it, so it's not my fucking business.
Yeah.
Which I was just like, oh, lady, you do not have a good grasp of the whole genre that you live in.
Right.
I make it my job to look at the most disgusting shit I can find.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it makes me a stronger person and it makes me more able to empathize. It makes me more able to like tolerate the nastiest, worst shit possible, because I feel like I can be a better writer, I can be a better podcaster if I ever take the leap to doing a job like in the crime arena. It would make me better at whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Whereas I know some people who are into the grimmest details possible don't want to ever see that. They can still hear it.
Oh yeah.
But it truly is a new
I don't
want to
look at
to
it
look at
yeah
it. Oh, I test myself all the time. I follow a lot of autopsy.
Can't do it.
We're very off track right now. But I follow a lot of autopsy and pathology Instagram accounts, and like the shit that they can post online is wild.
Nope. Can't.
Only thing I've ever stopped following was the crime scene cleanup people.
No.
That's just like, I don't need to see pictures of like decomposing dead body stains and poop in the same picture. Like, no.
Nope.
There's no reason. Nope. So, I think we kind of answered the question and gave 65 other questions.
In 10 different ways.
Yes. So overall, just a few quick notes on the authors and their works. Surely all of us, if you have never read an Anne Rule book, you at least know who she is because she's famous from Stranger Beside Me and her relationship with Ted Bundy. She wrote over 30 true crime books from the 80s into the 2010s. We both did, to call out some parts of her book that use dated language, less than a sensitive approach. Other than that, main criticisms you can find of her career seem to revolve around the book's subjects not agreeing with her, or people's families being mad at her.
Oh.
Which is fair.
Yeah.
The furthest one of these seems to have been taken was a court case in 2003, after her 2001 book Heartful of Lies was published about Lisa and Chris Northen. I think that I haven't read the book, and I didn't even read a synopsis other than what was in the Wikipedia page for it. I think that the situation was that Lisa possibly killed her husband, and then another journalist who was actually romantically involved with Lisa took out a full page like article in one of the local newspapers and was like, Anne Rule is flawed, she's biased, and like wrote a whole shit talking thing about her. And then they ended up back and forth in court for a long time over like slander and libel and lies.
Just plain devil's advocate, you have to be biased if the other side isn't willing to talk to you.
Right.
Like, right. Most of her books are one-sided because she's getting her information from one side of the family, from the person who thinks, you know, something wrong happened to their loved one. She's not getting the story from the suspected murderer.
Usually not.
Yeah.
So Anne Rule died in 2015 after complications from a heart attack that happened because of congestive heart failure. R.I.P. A fantastic author, R.I.P. in my opinion. She comes with her problems, but don't we all?
Right.
So David Reichert, before becoming a cop, he actually went to college for social work and served in the Air Force. He left the sheriff's office of King County in 2004 after he won a state representative seat for Washington's 8th Congressional District. And he served 7 terms there and did not run for re-election after 2017. So I think his last term ended on January 3rd of 2019.
Damn.
He is 69 years old. He is still with his wife, Julie, and they have 6 grandchildren between their 3 kids.
Wow. So is he retired now, technically?
Yep. I don't think he does anything. I mean,
good for you, Dave Reichert.
I'm sure he's the kind of person that gets a phone call still sometimes in the middle of the night. And it's like a rookie cop that's like, what should I do about this?
Yeah.
I want that for him. I want him to be able to still be a cop at home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I did write a couple. I was looking at like book club type questions, but they all seem to work for nonfiction.
Oh, right.
I mean, like they work for nonfiction, but not like not this story.
Yeah.
They don't really work for true crime. They work really well for fiction, kind of okay for nonfiction, and like not at all for this.
God.
Questions like, how did the story make you feel? Fucking horrible.
Awful.
Right.
Really, right. Really bad.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you want a deeper answer as to like how specifically Green River Running Red made me feel, it did make me feel honored to know any of those women's stories, especially because that case is from an era when sex work was absolutely unacceptable and like not that's not a protected group of people in any sense. It also made me feel inadequate that, like, I need to know more about the sex industry and, like, what I can do to prevent sex trafficking and rape and, like, what anyone can do to support people that do sex work. I mean, it made me feel good and bad as far as, like, police officers and investigation.
Yeah.
Because there's so much that went so right, but it's like you had them in the 80s. You could have done better.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to ask you a question since I took the first kind of half-assed one. How do you feel like you've changed since learning this story in detail?
Oh, okay. I mean, definitely still on to the victims. I feel like we overall do a good job at telling their stories, But after reading Ann Rule's book, like, it did make me realize, just not even just Scary Ridgway, but any serial killer, any killer who has like a name or a profile that's kind of well known, like, you don't know their victims, and that sucks.
Yeah. I mean, like, even if you really feel like bad. You do, you don't know anything about them.
Right. Or you know, just like, you just know the worst moment of their life, which was the end of their life. You don't know anything else. And that, yeah. So that it made me realize that. And I think it hopefully will change how I research and try to ensure that I have more information about a victim, if that is possible to find.
Yeah. I think
just like about their life. Yeah.
Yeah. It really reinforces this idea that I think people who can hold sympathy / empathy for the villain in any sort of story like this, like, I don't fully understand or care why Gary Ridgway was the way he is, but like, people are exposed to things, they have traumatic incidents in their life, there's a reason why people are the way that they are. And if you can set aside your own anger and outrage long enough to try to figure out what that is, you don't have to like it or care, but like, you have to know why they did that. Like, it's, you know, it's someone's whole job. And if you want that, go listen to LA Not So Confidential, as I've told you 1 million times. Yes. But like, it's a whole genre of work to understand why someone is doing something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's, as a civilian who like has no place in law enforcement, has no place in psychology, I think people like both me and Olivia, and like everyone listening, if you have the patience and tolerance to try to work through how grossed out you are and understand why it happened, it just makes you feel like shit because it happened, but you also feel like you have a greater understanding of all of it. Yeah. You have to understand it, or what can anyone ever do to stop it from happening again? Which clearly we don't know shit about in America.
That is very true.
It's just going to keep happening.
Oh, gosh. I also think, too, it helped me, like, have... It's given me, I guess, talking points. Not that I've ever been judgmental of someone who's been in sex work. And it is so different now. Like, it's way more... It obviously can be, like, a last resort situation. But I mean, I have friends who are in the sex work industry because they want to be in that, because they enjoy it.
Like, it's lucrative. It's more their chosen occupation.
Yes. But I think it's given me more talking points for people who do judge those people to be like, okay, yeah, like, you don't know their situation. You don't know where they came from, what they're doing, why they're here. Like, and here are 49 victims I could tell you about.
Right.
Of why they ended up in that situation. And no, not everyone's story is the same, but like, you know, it's just gives you some talking points to prove someone else's like judgment is incorrect.
55 reasons why you're fucking wrong, sir.
Yes. Let me list them out for you.
The other question I have is, what do you think about the overall style of writing? Like, if we are objectively analyzing these outside of the content itself, is the book like easy to read? Is it hard to read? Are there good descriptors in it? Is it convoluted?
Ann Rule's book is very hard to read. Agreed. I would say it's all over the place. It's not a book that we did not tell it how her book is written. We told it very chronologically. Hers is, I'm not joking, like, all over the fucking map. Like, from the beginning to end, it's just like, where are we? Who are, like, she'll bring up another, like, she'll bring up a victim's name hundreds of pages later after mentioning her, you know, at the beginning of the story for some reason.
Right.
It's just, it's all over the map.
Part of it's not her fault, because how could you possibly keep, like, there's a key in the very beginning of the book that lists, like, these are the key players of this story, and it's five pages long.
Yeah.
You can't possibly keep everyone straight, but.
And I think when you're so familiar with it, it's hard to come at it from a point of unfamiliarity. So it's like, she obviously knows the ins and outs, all of it, like the back of her hand, and then she's trying to tell it to people in a way as if they don't know anything, and she doesn't do that well.
Yeah, there's definitely parts where, because she goes back and forth about, like, she'll tell, I think she opens it up with, like, the first victim discovery, and then you go through, like, a series of victims, or, like, one dump site, and then it's his childhood. My main problem was that we all know who the culprit is here, and she discusses Gary Ridgway. She doesn't say his name until after he is introduced as a suspect by the police.
Yes.
She just calls him, like, the boy.
Yes.
Or, like, the man.
She writes it as if we don't know who the, who did all of this.
Which, like, as a literary device, I guess I understand, and I think that that would function and work for a different form of media. Like, a 45-minute podcast.
Right.
If you wanted to say one time that he was a fucked up kid that had mommy issues and then come back and say, oh yeah, that kid we mentioned, it's Gary Ridgway.
Yeah.
Everyone knows his name.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that would be fine. But we're doing it for 100 pages and it's exhausting.
Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously I read the whole book and I enjoyed it. Like, I'm not saying it's a bad book. Like, if you want to read it, read it. But it is a little hard to follow.
Yeah. I would say as far as David Record's book, it's very clean cut. It is pretty easy to understand. He does kind of go back and forth between, like, here's a chapter from this piece of the timeline that's about the case. And then in this chapter, right behind it, it's the same timeline, but we're talking about other things happening in my life. Kind of the same as Anne Rule. But he definitely had help writing that book, so it's pretty clear.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
I would actually say that Penny Moorhead's book, even though I think... you can kind of just tell by looking at her blog, like, I don't really know who she is. She doesn't really have a solid reputation as anyone that I'm aware of in the, like, writing industry or true crime world. But her, I was, like, shockingly delighted by her book.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Just the way that she writes about Judith's childhood is, like, if her story had ended up being different, I honestly think just with the way that Penny Moorhead wrote the book, I could have read about it. If the story ended with her getting divorced from Lee and then living by herself forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I was just entertained. And, you know, I don't know if that's because Penny Moorhead is a great writer or because Judith has lived a fucking life comparable to that of the Tiger King. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally.
But I don't know. I did love her book a lot. And I think it's very, very interesting. Again, it's this whole thing of, like, I have to understand. I have to get as close to it as I can. And if I don't have access to hear the full investigation of Gary Ridgway talking to the police, or if I can't hear his own internal monologue, hearing it from her perspective is the best option.
Yeah.
It's definitely written in a way that makes you see Judith as a victim and then as this, like, hero rising from the ashes at the end when she finds herself and is like, I get to move away from this and, like, be my own woman. It's nice. I think there are parts that are, like, it's just very obvious that we're writing it a certain way here, which is fine.
Yeah.
You just got to know that. Again, specific Anne Rule question, mainly for you because you've read the most books by her. How does this book compare to her other books that you've read?
Oh, that's a great question because I was going to add to the last one, but this is basically that question. I would say that if you have read an Anne Rule book before and liked it, you will like this book. If you have read an Anne Rule book before and disliked it, you probably won't like this book. Because it's basically triple anything she's ever written, you know? Or, I mean, same with Stranger Beside Me. That is all over the fucking place, you know? It's the same type of writing. Like, she's not... she's a good writer, but, like, in making things understandable, it's a lot.
Stranger Beside Me, for me, it was worse.
What?
I, like, couldn't focus at all on Stranger Beside Me. It took me so fucking
long
to
read like
it.
If you, like if you're, if something like that was a lot, this is the same level. I would say that personally, I enjoy her smaller books where she's covering something that's, like, just one person's death, not, not a serial killer. I think those end up being a better, more concise and clear story, but at the same time, it's just, that's just how she writes. She almost writes as she discovers things.
Yeah, it feels like,
instead
of, I'm gonna write about it, and then here's the thing, I'm gonna write about this, and then later someone else, like, reorganizes the bookshelf.
Yes. That's pretty much what it is. But I mean, I think it's comparable to her other books. I've liked her other books better than Green River, Running Red, or Stranger Beside Me.
I have only read those two, so now I have to pick one that you haven't read that's smaller and get another viewpoint.
I mean, I really liked whatever that first one that I covered in this podcast was. Like, that book was great.
Oh, I just looked that up and I was proud of myself that I remembered what the name was and now I don't know.
Was it something like The Still of the Night or?
Yeah, In the Still of the Night.
In the Still of the Night. Okay. Yeah, yes. That was very, very good.
Yeah, I think a single, like that would be an ideal situation for me as a reader coming from her as an author.
Yes.
One case where I can get the same level of detail, but it's just
yes.
much smaller and condensed. You know, it's just incredible how much detail goes into writing a true crime book about one murder.
Yeah.
50.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, final question. I don't know how it could possibly be, but is there any other information you wish you knew?
Oh my God. I wish I knew less.
Yeah.
I wish I knew less about Gary Ridgway. I mean, what do I wish I knew more about?
The only thing I could think of is I wish I knew if he killed that woman in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish there were more victims that we could solidly say were his. But like we kind of just talked about, he claims he won't confess to something he didn't do. But he also couldn't pick a victim out of a lineup of his because he didn't remember what any of them fucking looked like.
I know. And I wonder too at this point, like if he truly doesn't remember or like why he wouldn't just lay it out all on the table. Cause he's very old now. I don't know how old he is, but he looks like shit.
Yeah.
He's really old. And I just can't imagine like he had such incredible memory talking about what he did with the bodies, mm-hmm. how he did it. He couldn't tell you necessarily what a woman's face looked like, but he could always tell you like how long her hair was, how large her breasts were, if she had like small hands.
And where he noticed, put her, yeah.
Yeah, like he just knew so much of that. And it's like, he has to know if there are bodies out there that he feels that connected to them, he would know that there are some that they haven't found yet.
Oh, even yeah. And I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are in the state of Oregon, for sure.
Yeah. Because at one point he did confess to up to like 71 or 72, mm-hmm. but for whatever reason, like either he doesn't know anything about them, he can't remember, or that's bullshit.
Or honestly, knowing that he is so, I don't know, like fucking weird about his quote unquote possessions, what if there is a whole goddamn body site that has never been discovered? And he's just like, I'm keeping that to myself. Because he got very upset when his body sites were found.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. So, that if one exists there could be untouched, 10 more, he would never admit it.
There could be like 10 more victims there.
Ugh. Yeah, and one of the parts of the prosecutor's evidence summary, he's talking about like they're recounting what he told them. So they're all paraphrasing. But they said that his goal was to kill as many sex workers as possible during that stint in like late 83 or like early 84 where he was going nuts.
Mm-hmm.
That there were nights, like multiple nights in a row, like he would kill girls 3 nights in a row and would get 2 hours of sleep a night, or he wouldn't sleep at all. He would spend all night at the body site and then go straight to work.
Ugh.
And then like he started to slow down because he was so physically exhausted.
Mm. Yeah, I would say like knowing for sure all the victims, I would like to know that. Other information though, I don't want to know anything else about Gary Ridgway.
Yeah.
Literally nothing.
Hope he fucking enjoys prison time.
Yeah.
Which I think he is now. We have a Twitter friend from the podcast, well, her Twitter handle, PNW True Crime. That is a podcast, and obviously PNW True Crime. They're from the area. And she listened to our episodes and followed along and then tweeted me one day and was like, I have a present for you for your upcoming series. And then DM'd me a picture of an envelope that was addressed from Gary Ridgway.
Ew.
Since she's from the area, she's going to do an episode on him too and wanted to see what she would get if she wrote.
Yeah.
And she got a very traditional form letter back that's from whoever, it's from like two religious people that like handle his dealings now.
And yeah. they sent her a book about religion, like from some weird prophet guy, and a bunch of pamphlets on being a nice person, and...
Gross.
So that information's out there. If anyone feels a burning desire to write to him, you won't get anything back but a Jesus pamphlet.
Right.
Not really worth your time.
Definitely.
The only note I have left, the only thing I could find at this point that was happy, did you know that Anne Rule's daughter Leslie writes true books about ghosts?
No.
Yeah, she like picks different areas of the country and like writes ghosts of the Midwest and stuff like that.
Oh my God, I love that.
I know. I was like, that can be one of the books.
Yes. Talk about ghosts. Yes. Let's talk about some fun ghosties.
Sounds great after this.
Yeah.
But we already picked our next book for the series, and we are on it.
We're on it, you guys.
Like we said in the last Patreon episode, if anyone wants to read along, feel free to grab The Unicorn Killer. What is the second part of it?
The Secrets in Aquarius. In
Aquarius. The Unicorn Secret, Murder in the Age of Aquarius, yes, by Stephen Levy. That is
a fucking title, man.
And it is a fucking book. Like, yeah. I don't know what page I'm on because I'm reading on my phone, so it says there's like 6,000 pages.
Oh, God.
So I'm on like 450 of 6,000, but it says I'm like 6% of the way done with the book.
Yeah, that's probably about where I am.
And it is wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you would like to read along and know that story, go for it. If not, we will be bringing that to you at the end of April.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I got for this Ridgeway wrap up. I got to get out of this quarantine podcast room and eat dinner. I'm dying.
Yes. Same. I know. I got to figure out what we're doing for dinner. Well, stay safe, everyone.
Yeah. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Don't go outside. God damn it. Do not go outside.
Don't go outside unless you have to. And do not visit family members who don't live in your house.
Yeah. I'm a little annoyed that so many people on my social media feed don't understand that like social distancing is for situations where you have to go out. That doesn't mean invite people over.
Exactly. Like what?
I know.
My mom and sister dropped off cookies the other day, and I literally sat on the porch and they stood on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And we talked for like half an hour from that distance.
It's just like, my neighbor had people over and I was just like, what are you doing? They don't live here.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Ugh.
I know.
So yeah, stay safe. Do whatever you can to stay sane and happy.
Yeah.
And you know what? If that is drinking a shitload of wine and being a lazy fuck, then do it.
Then do that. I know. I kind of am annoyed at all these, like, being productive bullshit. And I'm just like, I'm literally working the same amount. I'm just able to get home earlier because I'm, like, already home.
Right. It's, like, a little bit of a break because I'm not teaching, but...
That's true. You do have quite a bit more time to do whatever you want, but you do not have to be productive. You can do whatever you want with that time.
Definitely. Well, I think it's the headspace where I crashed, like I ran into the wall, and then all of a sudden coronavirus was like, let me take this out from under you right now.
Yes, yes.
And I was like, oh, I have free time. And then I collapsed for a week and a half.
Which is what you should have done.
I know. I'm living my best dirty self.
Good for you.
How many COVID-19 showers have you taken?
I think I've taken two.
But I firmly know that in 10 days I've washed my hair twice. Fuck it.
Honestly, all of our hair is going to be a lot healthier after this.
I know. I haven't even seen you guys or posted a picture. I cut my hair off.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to grow mine out again now because my pictures didn't happen. So now I'm like, well, there's no reason to have short hair then.
I mean, it's gonna be long. Get your pictures later.
Yeah, but I want it longer for my wedding, so I can't cut it again until after.
First world probs.
I know. I know. It is true. Whatever okay.
gets us through. We gotta go. Yes. Thanks for tuning in one last time to talk about that fuckhead, mm-hmm. Gary Ridgway,
and then never again.
Nope. Never. We're closing again. The book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, that's a lie. I still haven't posted anything on our Instagram. I'm going to keep promoting this series so more people listen to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, now that it's done, we should do that.
Yeah. But anyway, thank you for tuning in one more time.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. And thanks for sending us questions.
Yes, thanks for participating, and thanks for supporting us on Patreon. You guys are the goddamn best.
Yes, yes.
Stay safe. Listen to all the podcasts.
Yes.
And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yes, in a couple weeks.
So till next time.
We're here to keep you up at night.
Hail Satan.
And pop some bottles.
And a fake little clink.
Bye, guys. Bum 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 b